The older woman considered her former student, then turned to regard Drizzt and the others, her gaze settling on Brunner.
"Older then, but wearing the same crown?"
she asked. And when the dwarf smiled, she added,
"The one-horned helm of King Brunner Battlehammer of Mithril Hall."
"Aye, she's getting it," said the dwarf.
Penelope turned to the beautiful young woman with auburn hair standing beside her and said,
"Catty Bree."
Catty Bree nodded.
"Was she your mother, then?"
Kipper asked Catty Bree.
"Or your great-great-great-grandmother, at the least?"
Penelope grabbed Catty Bree's arm and lifted it, pulling back the sleeve of her white gown to reveal the spell scar. She looked at Kipper and shook her head.
"Catty Bree,"
she reiterated.
"The companions of the hall," Drizzt put in. "All of us. Once great friends to the Harples of Longsaddle, who came to our aid in Mithril Hall in the time of troubles when the drow returned."
"I am too old for riddles," Kipper complained.
"But are you too old for a fine tale?" Catty Bree asked. Penelope's husband Dowell entered the room then, his smile going wide when he noted the return of the woman called Delly Curty. He looked around, happily at first, but his smile vanished when he regarded old Kipper, who stood with his arms crossed, a frown on his face, and tapping one shoe impatiently against the wooden floor.
"It seems that I have missed something," Dowell said.
The door closed, and all turned to see the foppish halfling leaning up against it. With a wide grin, Regis led the looks to the side of the room, where Wolfgar was already setting out an array of glasses and inspecting the bottles of Penelope and Dowell's private stock as he went. Apparently noticing the dumbfounded stares upon him, Wolfgar turned and met them with a beaming smile.
"What is a fine tale without an appropriate toasting beverage?" he asked,
looking at Regis as he did.
"You're gonna get me boy in trouble,"
Brunner whispered to the halfling.
"Count on it,"
the halfling replied. With a laugh, Penelope agreed, and she moved fast to clear enough of her desk for the large barbarian to bring over sufficient glasses and bottles. She settled back into her chair, Dowell and Kipper taking seats to flank her, and bade Catty Bree to spin her tale. Even as the woman moved before the desk to begin, though, Penelope held up her hand to stop her. The harpa leader then closed her eyes and whispered a spell. Indeed, a spell referred to as the magical whisper. Soon after, there came a knock on the door. On Penelope's signal, Regis opened it, and in came a line of younger harples, all bearing comfortable chairs for the guests.
"Do begin,"
Penelope bade Catty Bree when the students were gone and the door closed once more. A long while later, Penelope magically whispered once more, and soon after that a grand dinner was brought in. Through the meal, Catty Bree and the others continued their tale. Long into the night, Drizzt finished.
"And so we are here, with a dark road before us, and needing the friendship of the great Harples of Longsaddle once more." "For the sake of me Pwent," Brunner added.
Penelope looked to Dowell, and both deferred to Kipper.
"Already working on it,"
replied the old mage, who had appeared asleep until the weight of the gazes had stirred him.
"He will have to be resurrected,"
Kipper told Catty Bree around mid-morning of the next day.
"I see no other way."
The woman frowned and looked to the third person in the room, Penelope Harple.
"There is no cure for vampirism," Penelope said with a shrug. "None that I know of, at least.
Such a spell as resurrection is far beyond my abilities,"
Catty Bree said.
"Far beyond all but a few, and it won't come cheaply," Kipper stated.
and I doubt your friend will survive it. You understand that, of course?
Catti Bree nodded.
Ibbeldorf Puent was old and in failing health at the time of his infection,
Kipper went on.
So you have told me. And many decades have passed since then. You will likely raise him from undeath, only to deliver him to true death.
Better that,
Catti Bree said, and the others nodded.
Likely, yes, said Penelope.
And she dropped a hand gently on Catti Bree's forearm to comfort her.
But what is the point?
Catti Bree asked.
If Puent is doomed in any case, we can simply destroy him as is.
You would not wish to offer him the peace of alleviating his curse before he ventures to the netherworld?
Kipper asked. There came a knock at the door, and Penelope went to answer it.
I see no choice,
Catti Bree answered.
How am I to procure the services of a properly skilled high priest, and one who will venture to Gontalgrim?
Bring the vampire to the priest, when you find one,
Kipper said.
And as he spoke, Wulfgar entered the room. Ah, good, Kipper said. Do join us.
Wulfgar took the seat beside Catti Bree. She looked at him curiously, but he could only shrug in response, clearly as perplexed as she as to why he had been summoned to this meeting.
You have brought it?
Kipper asked. Wulfgar seemed confused for just a moment as Kipper reached his hand out, but then moved quickly to remove his silver horn and hand it over to the old mage.
A brilliant item,
Kipper said, rolling it over in his hands, then casting a spell to examine it more closely. He focused on the line of small but exquisite gemstones set in the silver.
From a dragon's lair, you say?
Penelope prompted, taking the conversation while Kipper continued his examination.
Icing Death.
The dragon Ewan Drizzt killed many years ago.
A lifetime ago,
Wulfgar said with a grin.
Have you used it?
Kipper asked.
Yes, almost immediately after I found it,
Wulfgar answered.
In the dragon's lair, on a hoard of treasure. Ice trolls had dogged me all the way to the treasure hoard, and by then had surrounded me. I thought my new life near its end, and blew the horn out of defiance and nothing more. Well, perhaps I hoped its notes would bring the ice ceiling crashing down, affording me some chance against the odds at least.
And the trumpet brought in allies,
Kipper said with a laugh.
Oh, how grand!
And have you used it since?
Penelope asked.
Only once, to confirm,
Wulfgar answered sheepishly.
It troubles you?
Penelope asked.
He thinks he is disturbing the sleep of the dead, and his culture frowns upon that,
Kipper answered before Wulfgar could.
Is that correct, son?
Wulfgar started to answer, but chuckled instead.
When I died, I was decades older than you are now, mage, he said. But yes, it is not my place to disturb the sleep of the dead.
Well, rest assured, friend, that you are doing no such thing,
Kipper said, and he blew the horn, a wheezing and broken note, but enough to enact the magic. Within a few heartbeats, the gems on the side of the silver horn sparkled, and a trio of warriors appeared, each armed with either a pair of hand axes or an axe and sword. They danced around the room for a bit, unsure of what was required of them, it seemed, until Kipper cast another spell and dismissed them back to nothingness.
It is a magic item, a tool,
the old mage assured Wulfgar as he handed back the horn.
Like Guinevar, Wulfgar replied.
Nay, the panther is much more than that, Penelope said. This is more akin to the whistle that summons Drizzt's unicorn.
These are not the souls of the dead warriors, Kipper assured. These are the magical manifestations of what the berserkers had been physically. But rest easy that the souls who inhabited those bodies have long gone to warrior's rest.
He looked at Penelope and nodded.
As I expected.
What am I missing here?
Catti Bree asked.
How is the horn relevant?
The magic of the horn is, or was, a spell meant to trap the soul,
Kipper answered.
Part of it, at least. There is much more imbued there that I do not understand, for it is a very ancient item. One long, long predating the spell plague, or even the time of troubles, likely. But the victims of that magic, the warriors who have since passed on, were caught there through the spell I mentioned, and such a spell might well aid you in catching your vampire friend.
Trap his soul in a gemstone, and bring the stone to a powerful high priest to finish the grim task,
Penelope offered.
I do not know this spell,
said Catti Bree.
No, and it is a powerful one, Kipper said. Perhaps beyond you, but I do not think so. With the help of a scroll, at least, and a gemstone worthy of containing such a treasure as a soul. And you have such items, Wolfgar assumed.
We prepared many things for the Bitterdews, just in case, Penelope answered. Werewolves, Catti Bree explained to her large friend.
I remember him,
Wolfgar agreed with a nod.
He left a legacy, in the forest.
Penelope Harple rose and offered Wolfgar her hand.
Come,
she bade him.
Let us leave Catti Bree and Kipper to their work. She has much to learn.
When they had left the room, Catti Bree turned to the old mage with a smile.
I knew you would help.
The world is a dark place, Kipper replied. But when friends join hands, it lightens.
Catti Bree nodded as she considered the generosity, and she wondered how much more the Harples might offer when the companions of the hall finished their business in Gauntlegrin and turned their warrior eyes once more to the Silver Marches.
Do you feel better about your toy?
Penelope asked as she led Wolfgar away. He walked with her down many halls and through a few rooms, and finally, out into the grand garden in back of the Ivy Mansion.
I do, Wolfgar admitted. I feared disturbing the sleep of the dead. It is not my place.
But you didn't destroy the horn, Penelope noted. Or put it away.
Wolfgar smiled at her, conceding the point.
It saved my life once, he admitted.
Yes, in a dragon's lair. So you and your halfling friend before that have told me, said Penelope. I would love to hear more about the fight.
Wolfgar paused and looked down at her.
Were you once an adventurer? Have you known the thrill of battle?
Or a theft?
Penelope asked, and reached up to tug the silver horn.
Proper pillaging, Wolfgar corrected with a laugh.
When I was younger, I found adventure,
the woman admitted.
In fact, it was on the wild road, in a steading full of hill giants, where I met Dowl and fell in love. In the midst of battle, no less.
He saved you? Wolfgar asked slyly.
Quite the opposite,
the woman replied. and she walked on down the garden path, moving between tall rows of high flowers and coming out into the full sunshine on the far end. Dowell is quite skilled at his craft, but he was never much of an evoker, and giants are not the most receptive creatures to charm spells.
Ah, but Penelope was, apparently. The woman laughed.
He didn't need them against my resolve.
His powers of persuasion must be great indeed to convince you to join this family, Wulfgar remarked.
And Penelope looked at him with a puzzled expression, as if she did not understand. I convinced him, she corrected when she had sorted it out. I am Penelope Harple by birth, not marriage. It was Wolfgar's turn to wear the puzzled expression. Dowell joined my clan and took my name, she explained. It was the least he could do after I pulled him from the grasp of a hill giant king, a hungry hill giant king, no less. Wolfgar laughed. I find your return to Toril the most curious tale among those of your group, Penelope went on. Catti Bree was bound by her goddess, Brunner by his sense of friendship, the halfling by a need to prove his worth. Be wary for him, for I suspect that his demands of his own courage will land him in dire straits in short order. But what of Wulfgar? You admitted that you did not immediately choose this path, yet here you are.
Bound by friendship as with Brunner, and including my friendship and debt to Brunner as much as to Drizzt, Wulfgar answered.
You owed nothing, and that friendship was long past by your own admission. She stopped and looked up at Wulfgar intently, forcing him to look her in the eye. After a long pause, he admitted,
Perhaps I fear death after all.
A strange admission from one who has existed on the other side of life.
What is to be found in Warrior's Rest? He asked.
Family, friends, comfort? Is that not what you expect?
Eternally.
The way he said it tipped her off. Eternal boredom, you mean?
I cannot say, but it matters not. If it is eternal, then it will wait, yes? And now I was presented with a grand adventure, another life of memories to make, and a worthy band of friends to make them beside. Why would I not return?
You seem quite the opposite of Drizzt, Penelope replied. He could not let go of Catti Bree and his former life, and you seem eager to do so.
Wulfgar pondered her words for a few moments, then slowly began shaking his head. Nay, not that, but merely to expand that experience, he explained. More battles to fight, more women to love, more food to eat and more spirits to drink.
So it is a grand game to you, then. Is there nothing more?
I know not, Wulfgar admitted.
So the aim of living is pleasure?
A fine goal, Wulfgar said lightheartedly. But Penelope would not let it go so easily.
There is a religion to support your theory, she said, and Wolfgar's expression immediately soured. More a philosophy, she quickly corrected. But it presupposes the absence of just reward. It calls the gods false, relegating them to superior mortal beings posing as deities for the sake of their own enjoyment, and at the expense of the lesser rational beings who inhabit the world, and also that they might control us.
You seem to know a lot about it.
It was Penelope's turn to laugh. I have been called unconventional. I think it a badge of honor. Wulfgar stared at her intently.
You miss the open road and the thrill of adventure, he stated.
I am too old, she started to reply, but his laughter cut her short.
I have lived a century and a quarter.
You have the body of a young man.
I have the lust of a young man, but only because I have lived through the dullness of being an old man, Wulfgar corrected. I have passed through pain and grief.
And love? He didn't deny it.
He lifted Aegis Fang from over his shoulder and swung it easily at the end of one huge arm. Every day, every experience, he said with a nod. Every thrill.
Like talking to an old lady in a sunlit garden.
Wolfgar's smile was wide and genuine, and his crystal blue eyes sparkled. Not so old, he said mischievously. Perhaps one day, you and I will go kill some giants.
Now Penelope was smiling too, and that was her answer, and it was a sincere hope that such an event might come to pass.
Truly, you remind me of a caged animal, Regis said to Brunner on the front deck of the Ivy Mansion one bright morning a few days later.
Spring was in full bloom, the air light, the wind warm, and the road beckoned, and beckoned none more than the grumbling dwarf. He paced back and forth, thumping his heavy boots against the wooden porch. He paused for just a moment to snort at the halfling, then went along again. Just down the path from the pair stood Drizzt and Wulfgar, working their weapons slowly and methodically in mock battle, with Wulfgar asking questions of his old mentor every few twists. Regis thought he should go down there and further his own training. Who better for him to learn from than Drizzt, after all?
Long road ahead, Brunner remarked, passing the halfling by on one of his pacing lanes.
Regis nodded.
Gontalgrim! Ah, wait till ye see it, Brunner went on. We'll catch us a puente and be on our way. Silvery moon, I say. Aye, we'll find us a priest there to do the deed, and then we'll set to chasing Obuld and his dogs back into their holes.
He continued on, muttering to himself as much as anything, for the notion of a long road ahead had sent Regis into some of his own ruminating. Yes, he'd travel to Gontalgrim, but might that be the end of the journey for him? Should he choose to go south from there instead of east to the Silver Marches, he was fairly confident that he could find Dorigardo and the Grinning Ponies early in the summer, with enough time to go back to Delphuntal and the waiting arms of his lovely Denala. The door to the mansion opened then, and Catti Bree came out, Penelope and Kipper beside her.
If he fights off the first try, you might consider just killing him then and there, Kipper was saying.
Drizzt and Wulfgar moved back to join them.
Here now, what's that? Brunner asked.
Catti Bree showed him a ring on her hand, golden and set with a black gemstone.
Stored within this ring is the spell we need to trap Puente's soul.
She rolled her hand, revealing a huge gemstone red as blood.
Ruby? Drizzt asked.
Sapphire,
Regis corrected, staring at the gem and licking his lips.
Phylactery,
Catti Bree corrected, and she tucked it away.
Ye said if it don't work, Brunner said to Kipper. Ye thinkin' it might not then?
Old Kipper sucked in his breath.
It is a difficult spell.
Me girl can cast it.
Oh, indeed, said Penelope. The ring Kipper has loaned her holds the spell intact. But still it is a difficult conjuration, and one an unwilling target can fight, sometimes successfully.
An unwilling dwarf, Kipper added, is never an easy target of any magical spell.
Nor an easy friend,
Regis quipped, drawing a glare from Brunner.
Kipper has shown me the spell. I have practiced, Catti Bree said. If the ring fails, I have this. She reached under the fold of her white gown and produced a silver scroll tube. But Kipper couldn't help but shake his head.
"Better to just destroy the vampire if he resists the magic," he said. "Trap the soul is difficult to enact. Only a mage of great experience can do so without the scroll, and even with it, I fear that you are not ready."
"Do not underestimate her," Penelope put in, and put her hand on Catty Bree's shoulder. "She has the favor of a goddess shining upon her, and is wiser in the ways of the world than her youthful appearance suggests."
"Yes, yes, I know," Kipper said. "Well, to you all, then, a farewell and a fair road. I hope you find your lost friend."
He bowed and went back inside, and the companions took turns bidding Penelope farewell, then started off down the hill for the gate to the Ivy Mansion, the road beyond, and the trails beyond that.
"There are rumors of giants roaming the foothills of the spine of the world," Penelope called after them.
Wulfgar grinned.
"Aye," Wulfgar answered her. "We might have to see to that."
"What was that about?"
Catty Bree asked when they were on their way again.
"Adventure," Wulfgar replied. "The same thing it is always about."
Chapter 11. Pawn to Queen Four.
"Speak not a word unless you are directly commanded to do so." Tosin Armgo's fingers flashed to his daughter Doomwheel, the two standing side by side, as ordered, on marks Berylips or Lauren had scratched on the ground.
"Do not move,"
she had warned them, the gravity in her voice impossible to miss. Something was going on here, Tosin understood, and it terrified him. Never had the Zorlarans been friendly to the House of Armgo, of course, but this was even beyond that measure of animosity. Berylip, a noble daughter and a high priestess, had been scared when she had ordered them to their spots.
"What do you think?"
Doomwheel started to ask. But her whisper became a shriek as the heads of four venomous snakes bit into her back one after another. The girl swooned under the burn of poison and the shock that Berylip was still so close nearby. Her legs wobbled beneath her as she slumped to the floor and she went to one knee. She would have slumped lower, except that a strong hand grabbed her under her upper arm and yanked her back upright.
"Weakling,"
Berylip whispered in her ear.
"Iblith. Perhaps I should drag you away and feed you to my driders, so that the matron mother will not have to suffer the disgust in looking upon such an abomination as you."
"She is a noble daughter of House Barrison del Armgo," Tosin said.
Berylip laughed and roughly shoved Doomwheel before walking around to stand before the pair once more.
"That says so much about the fraudulent second house of Menzo Baranzon, does it not? That they seek the beds of Iblith to expand their ignoble family?"
Tosin's eyes flashed, and Doomwheel expected him to return a verbal barrage at that, but surprisingly, he stood perfectly quiet and perfectly still, except that his jaw quivered just a bit. Doomwheel thought that curious and out of character, but then she realized that her father was not looking at Berylip any longer, but was staring past her. The younger Armgo sucked in her breath, and despite the continuing burn of the snake bites, forced herself to stand taller. Behind High Priestess Berylip Zorlaren came a procession of drow such as she had never seen before, such as she had never imagined before. Male warriors flanked the central figures left and right, marching with precision, in perfect step, arms and armor sparkling with magical power. Between those ranks, on a floating translucent disc that shined purple and blue, sat a woman bedecked in grand robes, laced and bejeweled with intricate designs of spiders and webs. A five-snake scourge rested across her lap, the serpent heads alive and writhing and clearly aware of the scene before them. Barrelip spun around and fell to her knees, eyes lowered to the floor. Should she do the same? Dumweel wondered. She glanced at her father, who stood perfectly still, his eyes lowered. Her gaze dipped to the floor, and she swallowed hard. The sight of her father, so clearly terrified, sweat upon his brow, had further unnerved her.
"Matron Mother Quenthel,"
Barrelip greeted, but did not look up.
"This is the son of House Barrison del Armgo?"
Matron Mother Quenthel Beanri asked, stepping off her disk and moving up beside Barrelip, waving for the High Priestess to stand up as she did.
"Yes. The Sabarak caught him in the tunnels to the east."
The Matron Mother turned a curious eye over Dumweel, first with intrigue, but with her face quickly scrunching up with open disgust.
"What is this?"
"My daughter, Matron Mother,"
Tosin dared interject, and Barrelip slapped him across the face. Quenthel pushed Barrelip back, though, and bade Tosin to look up at her.
"Your daughter?"
she asked, using the common tongue of the surface.
"Yes."
"A noble of House Barrison del Armgo?"
Tosin swallowed hard, something Dumweel surely did not miss.
"How lovely,"
Matron Mother Quenthel said.
"Such a thoughtful present you have delivered to me."
All three, Dumweel, Tosin, and Barrelip, looked at the Matron Mother with puzzlement.
"I wonder how proud your mother will be to know that her line is no longer pure,"
Quenthel remarked, her voice like the purr of a contented cat.
"Or will it be a secret she will want kept, do you suppose?"
Tosin swallowed hard and cast a plaintive glance at Dumweel, and the young half-drow saw the sudden regret in his eyes. He had erred in bringing her here. They should never have left the Silver Marches.
"Anzarel,"
Matron Mother Quenthel called, looking back to her line. A tall warrior rushed forward.
"Take her, and teach her what it is to be Iblith in Menzo Berenson."
"As I please," he asked.
"Just keep her alive,"
Quenthel instructed.
"How much alive, I do not care."
"No," Dumweel cried, grabbing for her sword. But Quenthel lifted her hand and uttered a single word, and the poor girl was sent flying backward. Kazidhea, the sentient blade, screamed in her head, telling her to stand down. But the headstrong girl picked herself up from the floor and stubbornly drew out the sword.
"Little Doe, no," Tosin cried.
Matron Mother Quenthel laughed wickedly. At her side, Anzarel drew out his two swords and calmly walked toward the poor girl.
"Back, I warn,"
Dumweel said. The weapons master of House Beanri came at her then in a blur of movement, spinning and dodging, his blades flashing brightly as they cut in circles and stabs. Dumweel thought herself a fine swordswoman, but never had she seen anything of this tempo and skill. And worse, Kazidhea would not cooperate, filling her head with doubt and calls for surrender. Anzarel's blade slapped hard against her sword, and Kazidhea sent a charge of discord into her head, dizzying her. Dumweel didn't know what to make of any of it. She saw her cherished blade go flying out to the side, clanging down on the stone floor. She saw Anzarel stepping in closer, saw the pommel of his weapon rushing to smash her in the face. Then she saw black spots flitting around her swirling vision. She felt the strong hands of the drow upon her, dragging her back. He was behind her, holding her upright. Five snakeheads danced before her eyes. Barrelip's whip had hurt her, so she had believed, but compared to the scourge of Matron Mother Quenthel, that strike had been nothing at all. In moments, Dumweel was on the floor, screaming and writhing in agony. Blow after blow descended upon her, viper fangs tearing at her flesh, burning poison streaming into her veins.
"Matron Mother, I beg of you," Tosin cried.
The matron mother turned an angry glare upon him.
"You have lived on the surface," she said. "How long?"
Tosin hesitated, and Doomwheel paid for his slip with another beating.
"Since the attack on Mithril Hall,"
the son of House Barrison Delargo blurted. Quenthel stared at him incredulously.
"I did not return to Menzo Berenzon," he explained. "I was lost and wandering."
"And you went to live with elves?"
"Yes. No. I found others. Drow of Chednasad, of House Soonwet and Carice."
"Where are they?"
"Dead. Long dead."
"And you stayed?"
"I had nowhere to turn, nowhere to go," Tosin explained.
"Until now."
"It was time to find my way home, with Doomwheel, my daughter, who is drow in heart and soul. She killed her brother, who was not akin to our wheel, who could not follow the Spider Queen, and I, too, struck down her mother."
"Dead?"
"Dead," he said. "I have left the surface behind, and only wish to return home."
The matron mother mulled it over for a few moments, then looked down at the battered girl.
"Perhaps,"
she said. But then she shook her head.
"Take her away,"
she instructed Anzarel.
"And teach her?"
he asked with a smile.
"Gently,"
Quenthel Bayenri said. Anzarel motioned for another of the Bayenri soldiers to retrieve the fallen sword. Noting the commoner drow's movement, Tosin cried out again,
"Take care! The blade is sentient, malicious, and powerful!"
That drew curious looks from both Bayenri nobles. The matron mother nodded to the weapons master, and he went over and personally retrieved the sword, gingerly picking it up. His eyes widened with shock immediately, and he held the blade aloft, clearly involved in a mental struggle for dominance with it. And then Anzarel threw Cazidea to the ground once more and stared at his matron mother with a look of shock.
"The Iblith child wielded it,"
matron mother Quenthel scolded.
"With much preparation," Tosin explained. "Dantrag!"
Anzarel cried, and he rushed back and scooped up the sword once more, now wearing a determined expression and squeezing the blood from his knuckles as he gripped the hilt.
"Dantrag!"
Quenthel Bayenri echoed, for Dantrag, her brother, was long dead, a century or more. Anzarel had known him, but what? Quenthel's eyes went wide with the shock of recognition as she stared at the sword Anzarel held.
"Cazidea,"
she whispered. She snapped her angry glare over Tosin.
"My sword?"
he asked innocently.
"The sword of Dantrag Bayenri,"
the matron mother corrected, and it was Tosin's turn to gasp in surprise.
"It cannot be," he mouthed.
"How did you get this?"
Matron Mother Quenthel asked sharply, her threat clear in her tone.
It found me,"
Tosin stammered. And he sounded very much like he knew he was about to die horribly.
"In a rocky canyon in the world above."
"A sword of such power?"
Quenthel snapped back incredulously.
"It had abandoned its wielder, I expected, or the wielder was slain, I do not know."
"Liar!"
"The sword agrees,"
Anzarel said through chattering teeth, and when the matron mother and Tosin turned to him, the weapons master threw the sword down once again. He stood there gawking and gasping for his breath.
"It is a blade of considerable power."
"Dantrag mastered it,"
Quenthel reminded him spitefully. She turned back on Tosin angrily.
"Where did you get it?"
"As I told you, matron mother,"
he said desperately.
"I believe that one of the companions of Drizzt O'Urden carried it, or perhaps the rogue himself."
He dared look up as he spoke that cursed name, and was relieved to see that it had the desired effect. for the matron mother visibly backed down, considering his words. She was weighing the region, no doubt, the Silver Marches, where Drizzt was known to roam, where Drizzt's friend had once been the dwarven king of Mithril Hall. Matron Mother Quenthel walked over and casually picked up Cassidea.
"The Beenry Blade," she said quietly, as if talking to herself, or perhaps to the sword. "Ah, my brother, a pity you were lost to us."
Quenthel's eyes widened suddenly in shock.
"Deceived by Drizzt," it said to me.
"It has told me the same, Matron Mother,"
Tosin dared reply.
"Traitorous rogue, it calls him,"
Quenthel said softly, and she focused on the blade again and seemed to be holding a telepathic conversation with it. A short while later, she walked back over, sword in hand. She moved to Anzarel, then with a mocking grin, moved right past him to stand before Tosin.
"Your blade," she said.
"It was,"
Tosin said, keeping his eyes low, and to his shock, and indeed to Anzarel Beenri's gasp, Matron Mother Quenthel handed the blade back to the son of House Barrison del Armgo.
"Sheathe it, and keep it there,"
the matron mother ordered, and Tosin accepted the blade with trembling hands and quickly put it away. The matron mother offered a look of disgust to Anzarel and motioned for him to gather up Dumwheel and be gone. She then instructed Tosin to walk immediately behind her as the procession left the chamber.
"Deceived by Drizzt O'Erden," she said,
turning back to him, and Tosin noted that she spat every word with utter contempt. What Tosin did not know was that this matron mother, Quenthel Beenri, had great personal history with the rogue named Drizzt, and indeed, she had been slain by his blades in the very battle that had left Tosin alone in the tunnels and mountains around the place called Mithril Hall.
"It is fortunate that you arrived when you did, matron mother,"
to Sabarak Zorlaren said. The matron mother had cornered him in his private chamber in the Zorlaren Gontalgrim complex, a situation that had made him clearly uncomfortable.
"Do tell,"
Matron Mother Quenthel replied, coolly, and without any hint that the wizard should relax. She liked having her subjects balanced on a precarious edge.
"The son of House Barrison del Armgo," the Sabarak replied, as if that should have been obvious.
"I did not come for him,"
Matron Mother Quenthel said, and then, slyly, she added,
"I came for you."
The Zorlaren wizard swallowed hard.
"Matron Mother,"
he asked,
"you were dispatched to the east to find the tunnels that would lead you to the land known as the Silver Marches,"
Matron Mother Quenthel explained.
"Yes, Matron Mother, and I have,"
the Sabarak quickly answered, and it was clear that he was fighting hard to keep his voice steady.
"The Armgo pair are but an added benefit."
"We will see,"
Matron Mother Quenthel replied.
"But they are not nearly as important. Do you know why you were sent on your journey?"
"No."
The hesitance in Tesabarak's voice was palpable.
"I do,"
Matron Mother Quenthel assured him. She offered a smile, but it was not a comforting one.
"And know that you will be returning, and soon, once you are prepared."
She moved to the door and pulled it open, then motioned out in the hallway adjacent to Tesabarak's quarters. In came Gromph, and Tesabarak bowed before the Archmage. As he rose, Gromph's companion entered the room, and Tesabarak's eyes went wide. He did well not to scream out, which was the expected reaction of anyone when an Illithid walked into his bedroom.
"You're a blessed one, Tesabarak,"
Matron Mother Quenthel explained.
"You will do your family great honor. I expect that you will return to this city of Q'Zorlaren and be awarded a place of high honor, perhaps even as Archmage of Q'Zorlaren, yes?"
She looked to her brother slyly. A rival to Grumph? The old Bayenry wizard scoffed at the absurd notion. And only because he understood the truth of this new incarnation of Quenthel did he resist the urge to magically melt to Sabarak before her then and there, just to prove a point.
Methil will show you the way, and will instruct you how to enact the spell,
Grumph explained to Sabarak.
Spell? The Darkening, Matron Mother Quenthel said. You are preparing the greatest battlefield of this age for the glory to the Spider Queen.
She nodded, then turned on her heel and left, but tarried long enough in the hallway to hear the first delicious screams of Tesabarak as the Illithid sent its tentacles into his brain. Methil wouldn't truly hurt him, she knew, indeed far from it, but none could feel that intimate intrusion without a bit of screaming after all. Her soldiers and scouts had spied out every corner of the Kuzor-Lauren complex, and Matron Zerath's children had done an impressive job of preparing the substructure of this ancient dwarven homeland to serve as a proper drow outpost. They would call it a city, but of course Matron Mother Quenthel would never let it rise to quite that level that it might rival Menzo Berenzon. She didn't knock on the next door, but pushed right through to find Sarabel Zor-Lauren, a minor priestess by all accounts, but one that Tiago had inexplicably decided to take as a wife. She stared at her in amazement for just a moment, then cried out,
"Matron Mother!"
and fell to her knees.
"Get up, child,"
Matron Mother Quenthel said. As Sarabel rose, Quenthel cupped her chin and forced her head up as well, that she could look her in the eye.
"I am returning to Menzo Berenzon with my entourage," the matron mother explained. "I will leave only a few behind, including the Illithid, who works with your uncle to Sabarak. The creature is of no concern to you or any others."
"Yes, matron mother,"
Sarabel replied, her eyes instinctively lowering. Matron Mother Quenthel grabbed her more roughly and forced her to look up once more.
"Tesabarak has work to do," she explained. "He will not be impeded. When he returns to the east, he will take as many of your contingent as he pleases. If he instructs any to join him, your sister or brother or even your mother, if Matron Zerath is here before he departs, then so be it. His word will be followed."
"Yes, Matron Mother, I will go if ordered."
"Not you,"
Matron Mother Quenthel sternly corrected.
"Now, you will gather Tiago and return to me in Menzo Berenzon. Where is he?"
"He is out of the complex, on the surface with Revel and others."
"I know that, you simpleton. Where have they gone?"
Sarabel blinked repeatedly and seemed as if she was looking for an escape.
"Dear child,"
Quenthel said, and her tone made it a clear threat.
"I had word of enemies," Sarabel blurted, "in a small city of humans and dwarves not far. They have gone to eradicate."
The matron mother blew an exaggerated sigh.
"Impulsive children," she said. "When they return, you will gather up Tiago and return to me at House Bayenry immediately."
"Yes, matron mother, but I was left here to prepare the way for Matron Zerath."
"You will gather up Tiago and return to me at House Bayenry immediately,"
Matron Mother Quenthel repeated slowly and evenly, her tone showing no room for debate.
"Yes, Matron Mother."
"Do not expect to return here," Quenthel Bayenry warned. "Ever."
Sarabel withered under those words and Quenthel's continuing glare, but she didn't dare argue.
"Fear not, child,"
Matron Mother Quenthel added with her knowing grin.
"You will find a place of honor in a fine house of Menzo Berenzon, and that is no small thing. Perhaps you will one day sit on the ruling council."
Even as she spoke the words, Quenthel thought them ridiculous, for Sarabel Zor-Lauren was hardly worthy of her surname. Even Matron Zerath had little to say about Sarabel that was not rife with derision.
But still, Quenthel thought, perhaps having such a stooge on the ruling council would secure her a second vote on any issue she wanted. Her smile turned genuine for just a moment before she reminded herself that she was getting way out in front here. Too many things still had to be accomplished before any of this would come to fruition, with the first battle of words no doubt looming. She had a surprising announcement to make, after all, when the next ruling council was joined, and even her allies at the table might take exception. But she was moving along the path beautifully, Matron Mother Quenthel Beanry believed. With the addition of High Priestess Manolan Fay to the Beanry ranks, and Gromph's coming child, House Fay Branch had been secured as an ally. The Avatar of Loth had confirmed the alliance clearly, and the Fay Branch family would never dare go against so obvious an imprimatur. And now Quenthel found herself on the verge of defusing the predicted battle between Anzarel and Tiago to the satisfaction of both, and to the benefit ultimately of House Beanry. She heard the continuing screams of Tesabarak Zor-Lauren echoing down the hall when she left Sarabel's chamber. She remembered when she had screamed like that, when Methil's tentacles had wriggled up her nose and into her brain. If only she had understood then, as she did now, the beauty Methil had been imparting to her, the understanding of the millennia, the wisdom of her great mother, the clear vision of Lady Loth's grand scheme. Quenthel would welcome another intimate intrusion by the Illithid, if such a gain was to be found again. She suspected that Tesabarak would feel the same. He was learning the spell now, perhaps the greatest spell a drow would cast, at least since Matron Mother Evenel Beanry had created the tentacles that had grabbed House Oblotra and torn it from its stone roots to drop the whole of the place into the claw rift.
The darkening,
she whispered as she moved along, and she wished that she could go all the way out to the east with Tesabarak to witness the beauteous spectacle. She had only one more visit to make before heading home to Menzo Baranzon, and she waited patiently in the hall, enjoying the music of the screams for just a short while, until Gromph came out of Tesabarak's room, Methil close behind.
"Tesabarak is prepared?" she asked.
"Almost," the Archmage answered. "He will scream again, but at least now he has come to understand that there is indeed a reason. Still, we will find some pleasure in his pain."
Quenthel smirked at her brother, who was indeed, she knew, finding great pleasure in tormenting Tesabarak. As much as Gromph tried to deny it, Quenthel suspected that there was a bit of trepidation and even envy within him regarding Tesabarak. Or perhaps she just hoped there was. The trio went to Berylip Zor-Lauren's room, collected the High Priestess, and traveled to the forge, where goblins scrambled all around to supply the drow craftsmen as they worked their magic.
"I have heard much of this place," the matron mother said to Berylip. "Blacksmith Golfanon has told me that there is no forge upon Toril to exceed the heat and power of this one."
"He does not exaggerate," Berylip assured her, and she waved her arm out at the great forge of Gontalgrim, set in the middle of the long and narrow chamber.
"It is an oven."
"I do not need to view an oven," Matron Mother Quenthel said with a derisive chortle that set Berylip back on her heels.
"Show us the source of the power within those furnaces," Gromph explained, and the Zor-Lauren priestess nodded excitedly and hustled to a small mithril door set back behind the main forge, halfway along the room's long side wall.
Beyond it lay a narrow tunnel that had once been sealed with several doors, it seemed.
"Portals designed by dwarves to keep all others out,"
Berylip explained as they passed through one empty jamb where a door had been removed. The air grew humid, then steamy. They could hear the sound of falling water and an angry hissing noise in response. The tunnel wound for many paces before ending at another door, this one slightly ajar. Berylip pushed it open and led them through, spilling out into an oblong chamber. A chamber that was alive with the power of the elements.
The chamber was cut wall to wall by a very deep pit, into which a perpetual waterfall poured from the ceiling.
"Do you feel it, Archmage?"
Matron Mother Quenthel said. And she closed her eyes and moved forward, basking in the power of the primordial. With Gromp beside her, she moved to the edge of the pit and looked down at the bared power of Gontalgrim, who knew best the beauty and grandeur of the City of Spiders, and even for the Archmage of Menzo Baranzon, who had walked the plains, such a sight as this surely stole their breath. They could not see the walls of the pit, for they were obscured by a spinning vortex of water, leaving water elementals forming the shaft prison for the beast far below. Through that spray and mist it loomed, the fire primordial, a living beast older than the dragons, older than the gods, perhaps. It was trapped, but it was not still. Nay, the bubbling lake of lava popped and spat forth its fire and magma, vomiting them upward to fall against the watery wall of the spinning vortex, the endless battle between fire and water. The two Beenris stepped back from the ledge and turned to look upon a beaming Berylip.
"This is,"
the matron mother started to say, glancing around and shaking her head as if in disgust, which stole more than a bit of Berylip's bluster. The matron mother stared her in the eye.
"Why have you not prepared this room?"
Matron. Mother.
Berylip stammered, hardly able to grasp the dangled concept.
"The room is functional, perfectly so. The forge is..."
"Functional?"
Matron Mother Quenthel snapped incredulously, and Gromph gave a little laugh.
"This is not functional," she insisted, spitting the last word as if it rang out as a tremendous insult to her sensibilities. "This is majesty. This is glory. This place, that beast, the elementals trapping it, are the reason Lolf has allowed your departure from Menzo Baranzon. Do you recognize that, priestess?"
"Yes, matron mother, of course."
"Then why have you not prepared this room?"
the matron mother emphatically demanded. Berylip's lips moved, but she said nothing, so at a loss as to even know where to begin. Quenthel pushed past her impatiently, moving out to the center of the flat stone area and surveying the room.
"That tunnel?"
she asked, pointing to a second exit from the place, just down the wall from the door through which they had entered. She could see that it was a natural tunnel, perhaps a lava tube, burned out from the stone.
"Where does it lead?"
"To a back corridor, matron mother,"
Berylip answered.
"See where it joins the outer corridor,"
Quenthel instructed Gromp, who nodded and started across the way.
"I will put up a wall of iron, but it may be dispelled," he informed her.
"Seal it,"
she said again,
"and then the Zorlaran craftsmen will construct more permanent walls to support your magical construct." "This place!"
Quenthel exclaimed, and then she began to dance, slowly turning, and she began to sing an ancient song of the founding of Menzo Baranzon for the glory of the Spider Queen. Her twirls became more enhanced and rapid, her spidery gown flowing out wide from her slender form, and from that gown dropped small spiders, living spiders, that scurried away from her as if they knew their task. For indeed they did. The song of consecration had brought them to life from the magical garments of the matron mother of Menzo Baranzon, and that song told them. Gromph came back out of the tunnel a short while later, his wall constructed to seal off the far end. Quenthel continued her song and dance. Spiders ran all around the ledge and up the walls, many already trailing their filaments. Quenthel twirled around and then stopped abruptly, dramatically, her grasping hands cupping at the front of her shoulders, at green, spider-shaped brooches she wore. She tore them free of her gown, her song becoming a powerful chant and plea to the Spider Queen, and she threw those brooches out to the floor before her, where they landed and skidded and animated, and grew.
"This is the chapel of Kuzor Laren," the matron mother declared to Berylip.
and now the jade spiders were the size of ponies, then the size of horses, then the size of umber hulks. One moved to stand beside the door through which they had entered, the other to flank the tunnel Gromph had sealed. And there they froze in place, perfectly still, guardian statues.
"Matron Mother,"